minus 10 seconds and counting. 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
John Kennedy's death commands what his life conveys. That America must move forward.
This is the greatest week in the history of the world since the creation.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief. It was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the season of despair. It was an age of tragedy and death and mourning, as the age-old reality of man's inhumanity to man cast a shadow over all we did, all we hoped to do. As the decade of the 60s began, those hopes were centered upon one man.
The election may have been a close one, but I think that there is general agreement by all of our citizens that a supreme national effort will be needed in the years ahead to move this country safely through the 1960s. I ask your help in this effort, and I can assure you that every degree of mind and spirit that I possess will be devoted to the long-range interests of the United States and to the cause of freedom around the world.
The world that John F. Kennedy faced as he moved into the presidency was a world caught in the chill of the Cold War. The hopes for peaceful coexistence with the communists had been dashed, and a new and dangerous confrontation between the Russians and the United States seemed more than likely.
Premier Nikita Khrushchev gave a luncheon at Soviet Embassy headquarters on Park Avenue. Present were leaders from communist as well as neutralist countries. Janos Kadar, Gamal Abdel Nasser, Crown Prince Hassan of Morocco, and Prime Minister Nehru of India were among those who attended. Posing in front of the embassy for photographers afterwards, an atmosphere of harmony seemed quite evident.
American confidence was at a low ebb and was destined to sink even lower. April 12, 1961, the Russians put Major Yuri Gagarin into space, in orbit, around the Earth.
Today, the first cosmic spaceship named Vostok, with a man on board, was orbited round from the Soviet Union. He is Airman Major Yuri Gagarin, an Air Force pilot, a citizen of the Union of the Soviet Socialist Republic.
Less than a month later, May 5th, 1961, an American rockets into space. Commander Alan Shepard. It is a short flight and does not go into orbit.
0.8G, 8PSI, cabin, and the oxygen is go. Cabin pressure is holding at 5.5. Cabin holding at 5.5. Oxygen go. All systems are go.
The Shepard flight signals that the United States is in the new contest for supremacy in the Cold War, the space race. But it is a race in which the United States is far behind, and there are fears that the race will be lost. Not until February 1962 does an American orbit the Earth. Lieutenant Colonel John Glenn.
4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Liftoff. The clock is operating. We're underway.
Roger. Reading you loud and clear.
Roger. We're programming it roll okay. A little bumpy along about here.
Roger. Stand by for 20 seconds.
Roger.
3, 2, 1, mark.
Roger, backup clock is started. Fuel 102, 101, oxygen 78, 100, amps 27.
Roger, loud and clear, flight path is good, 6-9.
Roger, checks okay, mine was 70 on your mark.
Roger, stand by.
Roger, 0G, and I feel fine. Capsule is turning around.
Oh, that view is tremendous. Roger, turnaround has started.
Capsule turning around, and I could see the booster during turnaround just a couple of hundred yards behind me. It was beautiful.
Roger, 7, you have a go. At least 7
interstellar orbits. This is Friendship 7. I can see clear back a big cloud pattern way back across toward the Cape. Beautiful sight.
Roger, still reading you loud and clear. Next transmission, Bermuda.
Later in the year, September 12th, President Kennedy makes a commitment to win the space race, to put Americans on the moon before the end of the decade.
We set sail on this new sea because there is new knowledge to be gained and new rights to be won, and they must be won and used for the progress of all people.
Brave words by a president who knows the United States starts its voyage on that new sea with enormous obstacles to overcome. But as months go by, Americans become familiar with the names of heroic men who gladly shoulder the burden the new president has put upon them. Scott Carpenter, Walter Schirra, Gordon Cooper, Edward White, Roger Chaffee, James McDivitt, John Young, Conrad, Lovell, Borman, Stafford, Scott, Cernan, Collins, Aldrin, Isley, Cunningham, Schweikert, Gordon, Scott, and Neil Armstrong. A man for whom history had saved a unique place.
I'm at the foot of the ladder. The lamb footbeds are only depressed in the surface about 1 or 2 inches, although the surface appears to be very, very fine-grained as you get close to it. It's almost like a powder. Ground mass is very fine. I'm going to step off the limb now. That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
The time on Earth, 10:56 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, July 20th, 1969. A man, an American, on the moon in this decade, and a promise kept.
Only if the United States occupies a position of preeminence can we help decide whether this new ocean will be a sea of peace or a new terrifying theater of war.
War. In the years of the 60s, as in countless years before, war was stalking the face of the earth. There was not just one war, but many. Civil war in the Congo, Nigeria, and in Latin America. War between Arabs and Jews in the Middle East. Fighting between India and Pakistan. In Laos, in Indonesia, and between the Russians and the Chinese communists. War and the threat of it. Here in 1962, was what many consider Adlai Stevenson's finest hour.
All right, sir. Let me ask you one simple question. Do you, Ambassador Zorin, deny that the USSR has placed and is placing medium and intermediate range missiles and sites in Cuba? Yes or no? Don't wait for the translation, yes or no?
I am not in an American courtroom, sir, and therefore I do not wish to answer a question that is put to me in the fashion in which a prosecutor does. In due course, sir, you will have your reply.
I'm prepared to wait for my answer until hell freezes over, if that's your decision.
Little wars and big ones. A little war was going on in Vietnam, where local communists, supported by communist North Vietnam, were fighting against the government in Saigon, headed by Ngo Dinh Diem. President Kennedy, continuing the commitments already made to the South Vietnamese, sent 16,000 American military advisors to South Vietnam, and in 1962 sent his personal emissary, General Maxwell Taylor. Encouraging was a word Americans would hear a lot when Vietnam was discussed. In 1962 and 1963, the policy was to support the Diem government. But by November of 63, it is clear to Washington that Diem is an unpopular leader. The word goes out, Diem must go. He and his brother are killed, their government overthrown. Madame Nu, sister-in-law of the deposed Diem, points an accusing finger at the United States.
To stab them in the back, or to suppress them while they are winning the war, in order to rob them the results of their hard and disinterested efforts for their country, will only bring to them more glory, while it will only stigmatize all those involved in that dirty crime.
In the postmortems after the ZM affair, there was a comment from the American who first extended a helping hand to ZM, former President Dwight Eisenhower.
He lost touch with the mass of the people, and that is a very unfortunate thing in such a country.
With ZM gone, the American government faced the question of who would succeed him and what help the successor would get from America. January 1964, Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara, appointed by President Kennedy, stays as Secretary of Defense into the administration of Lyndon B. Johnson, as does Secretary of State Dean Rusk.
There could be a political settlement if Hanoi and Beijing were to adopt a policy of leaving their neighbors alone.
But the Vietnam War would bear the personal imprint of the President of the United States.
In South Vietnam, terror and violence, directed and supplied by outside enemies, press against the lives and the liberties of a people who seek only to be left in peace. For 10 years, our country has been committed to the support of their freedom. And that commitment we will continue to honor.
At the United Nations, Ambassador Adlai Stevenson offers a way to peace in Vietnam.
Stop the secret subversion of other people's independence. Stop the clandestine and illegal transit of national frontiers. Stop the export of revolution and the doctrine of violence.
Violence in 1964 was to increase in Vietnam. August 2nd, an incident in the Gulf of Tonkin.
Preliminary and fragmentary reports have been received of a nighttime incident in the Gulf of Tonkin. There's been no damage reported by American vessels and no loss of American personnel.
The President of the United States acts.
The attacks were deliberate. The attacks were unprovoked.
The level of violence rises. The term used is escalates. In February 1965, after an attack by the communists on the American base at Pleiku, the President orders bombing raids against North Vietnam. By the spring, the Johnson administration is embroiled in the Vietnam fighting and getting in deeper. July 28th, the President.
I have today ordered to Vietnam the Air Mobile Division and certain other forces which will raise our fighting strength from 75,000 to 125,000 men almost immediately. Additional forces will be needed later, and they will be sent as requested.
And the President offers his explanation for why the United States has become involved in a land war in Asia.
We just cannot now dishonor our word or abandon our commitment or leave those who believed us and who trusted us to the terror and repression and murder that would follow. This then, my fellow Americans, is why we're in Vietnam.
It is the President's conclusion that the way to peace in Vietnam is through war.
But I also know, as a realistic public servant, that as long as there are men who hate and destroy, we must have the courage to resist, or we'll see it all. All that we have built, all that we hope to build, all of our dreams for freedom, all will be swept away on the flood of conquest. So, too, this shall not happen. We will stand in Vietnam.
There were those who disagreed with the President's war policy. Some burned their draft cards. The dissenters were not all young rebels. A number of congressmen were against it, and chief among them was the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, J. William Fulbright.
Dissent is healthy rather than unhealthy, or it is something that should be engaged in, because it causes us, whether you're a senator or a member of the executive, to examine more carefully the basis for your decision.
As the tempo of the war increased, dissension increased at home. The country divided on the war. You were a hawk or a dove. To many, dissent was equated with disloyalty, and those who dissented were the object of criticism themselves. Typical was this comment about Senator Fulbright from Senator Barry Goldwater.
This carping criticism of any show of American firmness brings joy to the hearts of our enemies. It confuses our allies, and it demoralizes our troops.
At times, the war itself was obscured by the debate over the war at home. Inevitably, the war became an issue in politics. And at the center of the political divisions in the country stood the President of the United States.
The rules are suspended, and the Honorable Lyndon B. Johnson is nominated by acclamation as our candidate.
Accept your nomination. I accept the duty of leading this party to victory this year.
Lyndon Baines Johnson, accepting his party's nomination for President of the United States, making him his party's nominee in his own right. He had come to the presidency in a time of deep grief and anguish, succeeding to the job with the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Then his task had been to bring the country together, to bind up the wounds. To do so, he went before the people and the Congress, their president.
Assassin's bullet has thrust upon me the awesome burden of the presidency. I cannot bear this burden alone.
For the next year, Lyndon Johnson carried that burden, and through his unmatched ability to deal with Congress, managed to get congressional action on large portions of the Kennedy program.
No memorial oration or eulogy could more eloquently honor President Kennedy's memory than the earliest possible passage of the Civil Rights Bill for which he fought so long. No act of ours could more fittingly continue the work of President Kennedy than the early passage of the tax bill for which he fought all this long year. That bill, if passed without delay, means more security for those now working, more jobs for those now without them, and more incentive for our economy. John Kennedy's death commands what his life conveyed, that America must move forward.
By the summer of 1964, Lyndon Johnson had clearly established that he was president, and there was little doubt that he would be his party's nominee for president when the Democrats met in convention in Atlantic City. In accepting the nomination, Johnson chose as his running mate Senator Hubert Humphrey of Minnesota. For the Republicans that year, the candidate for president was conservative Senator Barry Goldwater of Arizona.
I would remind you that extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. Let me remind you also that moderation in the pursuit of justice is no virtue.
Goldwater's running mate, Congressman William Miller of New York. He and Humphrey debated the issues.
The greatness of America is not the conscience of a conservative, but the greatness of America is our conscience of social justice.
Now, since this campaign has started, and since we have been able to develop the issues, we find that there is little discussion now on the other side of this issue of extremism, namely because they selected probably one of the greatest extremists in their party as a candidate for Vice President of the United States.
There is no new Goldwater. There is only the same old impulsive figure from a never-never land of his own making, a land, as my distinguished colleague Senator Eugene McCarthy so eloquently put it, in which the calendar has no years, in which the clock has in no hands, and which the glasses have no lenses.
We simply say, we Republicans, that farmers should not be serfs of the federal government.
We got Bobby Baker and Billy Saul Estes, and Lyndon Johnson had the colossal nerve at Atlantic City to get up before the American people and say, let us continue.
I've listened to these candidates that go up and down this land trying to divide the South from the North, trying to divide labor from farmer, trying to divide the city from the rural, trying to divide you from the federal government and the local government. Those are the voices of disaster and doom. Those are the voices that should be repudiated by every red-blooded, decent-thinking American. We need in America unity, not disunity.
And while the vice presidential candidates had it out, so did the presidential contenders.
I know the strength of this nation. I know that we can live as we live now, prosperous, progressive, and unafraid, so long as we live together, united, forward-looking, and undivided.
Congress is headed toward adjournment, and if Lyndon Baines Johnson has his way, it will adjourn in the biggest splash of whitewash Washington has ever seen.
This year and every year, the prosperity of the many must not be sacrificed to the partisanship of the few.
We are headed, ladies and gentlemen, toward the law of the jungle, where they shall take who have the power and they shall keep who can. Unless person and property are secure from the marauder, we have no government worthy of the name.